This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Our guest today, let me tell you something. I have looked everywhere in Major League Baseball, and I can only figure out two things he's never done in Major League Baseball. Umpire, athletic trainer. But I think he probably had to be an athletic trainer somehow along his career path. Folks, Pete Caliendo, you're listening to Baseball Outside the Box. Thank you for joining us. This is the show which interviews baseball's best coaching minds who at times they do love the challenge of status quo, and I love that. That's why it's called Baseball Outside the Box. Welcome our audience on Facebook. We're going to get to our guest right away. Appreciate it. Welcome everybody in the U.S. and around the world. Let me tell you about Bo Porter. This guy's a special person, and I am so honored to have him because he is a superb person who has done so much in the game. Let's just get started with not only was he a major league player. Now, he was a multi-sport athlete, grew up out in Jersey, went into as a major league player. He managed in the big leagues. He coached in the big leagues. He was assistant GM, a broadcaster, third base coach, base running coach. I mean, he has done so much, but then he's gone on to take all his experiences, and now he's a keynote speaker. He's an author. He's got several books. He's an entrepreneur, a philanthropist. It is so great to have him. Let's welcome Bo Porter from Bo Porter Enterprise. How you doing, Bo?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thank you so much for having me on. You sitting there, you naming off all of those hats in which I've worn. I'm sitting here going, did I do all of that? And I tell you, I don't claim it. I'm extremely blessed. And you said it, coming from Newark, New Jersey, and being able to have the opportunity to do all the things in which I've been blessed to do, I give a lot of the credit to my upbringing and to the people that I've been around and have had the privilege to play for. I played for some great managers, some great coaches, some great leaders. And I think that we all are a combination of all the people in which we surround ourselves with.
You know, what a great way to start. And I'll tell you why, because I want to go back to your childhood, because I heard there were, you had some rough times in your childhood. It wasn't just an easy upbringing. And at times I think, I have to say I had it easy. No doubt about it. Italian parents, they came over, they had a tough time. Obviously come over from Italy, they were never easy, didn't speak the language. But as far as I'm concerned, they brought me up. I had everything. I didn't have a lot of money, but I had everything I needed. So I want to get to that, your childhood a little bit, how you grew up. And like you said, who influenced you? What got you started in everything?
I tell you, it's when people talk about philanthropy, and those that don't know my story, it's pretty clear, why having a hand in and helping other people was so paramount for me. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, on 14th Street and Avon Avenue. We did not have Little League baseball. My mom was a single parent. She had me at 16 years old. And so it was pretty rough. We had to play baseball in the church parking lot. We had to play football in the middle of the street, pole-to-pole football. Basketball, we took a milk carton, the containers that the milk cartons used to come in. We nailed it to the tree, and that would be our basketball court. But I got my start in baseball. It was a neighborhood friend who lived across the street from the church parking lot in which we played. I would hit the ball out of the parking lot, and I would break the window across the street. The house was owned by a man named Mr. Taylor. He would come over to my mom, say, listen, Bo's broke my window again. My mom would say, listen, put me on a payment plan. These kids have no place to play. Long story short.
It's great.
Taylor worked at a bank on the other side of town, and he was a security officer. On his lunch break, he's walking down the street where they did have Little League. It was called South Ward Little League on Leslie Street and Lines Avenue in the South Ward of Newark, New Jersey. He sees a flyer for Little League tryouts. He brings it back to my mom. He said, hey, listen, I sit on my porch. I watch all of these kids play. Have you ever thought about putting Bo into Little League? My mom gave him all the reasons why I can't play Little League. She said, first of all, there's no Little League around here. I don't have a car. How is he going to get there? I'm pretty sure there's a fee. Mr. Taylor, the kindness of his heart, he says, well, if I sign him up and I pay the fee and I agree to take him twice a week when he has to go over there, will you let him play? He took down all the barriers. My mom, she goes, yes. I mean, if you're going to do all of that, I mean,
wow. Why not?
So he takes me over there. I try out. I get selected with the number one pick, the team that finished in last place the year before. My coach was a man named Mr. Miller, bless his heart. He was a diehard Yankee fan. We go on to win the next three championships in Southwest Little League, but Mr. Miller worked in New York on Wall Street. His job gave him tickets, complimentary tickets, 12 tickets to the New York, I mean, 15 tickets to a New York Yankees game. He decided he was going to take the 12 kids on the baseball team. That was the first time I ever left Newark, New Jersey. I go to Yankee Stadium, and I'm sitting there June 28th, 1981, and I'm sitting there, and I go, wow, I want to play Major League Baseball. And it hit me. And that's why I say this to kids all the time. The untraveled eye can't see. Mm. And because I had never been out of my own environment, Mr. Miller put me into an atmosphere that allowed me to dream big. And again, I wasn't a bad kid. I got good grades in school. You know, I loved playing sports. But from that day moving forward, I now had a greater goal that I was trying to accomplish, and it turned me into a harder worker. I was more dedicated. I was more focused. I got Dave Winfield and Willie Randolph and Don Mattingly autographed that day. And, you know, it just inspired me to want to do more. And the rest of the, you know, baseball career kind of takes off from there. But that was my start into organized sports. And it came by way of a kind gesture from a neighbor across the street because he got tired of me breaking his windows.
Amazing. And I love it. The untraveled eye can't see. I'm never going to forget that because I'm fortunate. I've been lucky to travel the world since I went to Italy my very first time at 3 years old with a flight attendant. So again, very lucky to be able to see the world. And I certainly understand what you're talking about. That's why I believe there's some great things. We'll talk about it happening in the inner cities with baseball. And we need to, you know, develop those programs even more because a lot of young people, whether it be African-Americans, Latin kids, you know, aren't getting that opportunity to play because one, it's an expensive sport. But the other thing I want to talk about, and we'll continue some of this also, I want to ask you, during that time period, did you, you know, when you first went to the stadium, when you saw everything and you wanted to be a big league player, did you think about how you're going to get there?
Yes, I did. And I tell you, I sat there and, you know, you would watch the games on TV, you know, here and there. But sitting in the ballpark, it was a different kind of energy. It was electric. It was entertainment. And I imagined myself playing on that very field. I imagined myself one day, you know, playing in Yankee Stadium. And I'm going to fast forward and then we can come back. Fast forward to 2000, I am playing for the Oakland A's, and we come to Yankee Stadium to play the Yankees in the postseason, in the playoffs, and Mr. Taylor is sitting in the stands watching me play Major League Baseball.
Incredible.
Against the New York Yankees. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
He stayed in touch with you throughout your career?
Because obviously he lived on the street in which I was born and raised. So when I went off to college, he kind of followed, you know, everything that was going on in my career as I, you know, went to high school and college. And then when I got drafted, and he was blessed enough. He was much older then by that time. He ended up passing away. But I hold true to my heart just the joy that he was able to experience by seeing me and witnessing me play Major League Baseball in Yankee Stadium?
Both two things I could think of. One, playing where you started off. You know, we talk about being uncomfortable, you know, and we look at the Dominican Republic, Cuba, the fields they play on. They're so uncomfortable that all of a sudden when they get here, it's like it's easy for them because they've had all the rough parts that, you know, they played with a stick. They played with a baseball taped up. You know, they've had bad bounces, all that. I want you to talk about the importance of that and also you being a multi-sport athlete, how that helped you in your career.
Well, I'll start with the multi-sport athlete. I think that, you know, one of the things that's happening in our country is I think kids are specializing in one sport way too soon.
Yes.
I think it causes a lot of injuries. I think it also causes burnout. I think when you start to think about, you know, development, I think you need to develop the whole, you know, person. You need to develop every aspect of your game. So when I look back at my career, I think football made me tougher. Basketball gave me agility and plyometrics and, you know, the man-on-man aggressiveness that comes with basketball and the timing and balance and rhythm that it takes to play the game. Then you go to baseball. Baseball is a skilled repetition sport that has a lot of failure. So you have to be able to develop fortitude. I think all of the different sports in which I played, it made me whole. I think a lot of times kids pigeonhole themselves in. And I say pigeonhole because for a long time, it wasn't until I was drafted in baseball after my junior year that I made a definitive decision, you know, that I still wasn't ready to make that last decision of do I want to play in the NFL or do I want to play Major League Baseball? But after my first year of baseball, I come back to Iowa to play my senior year of football. It was at that time where at that very moment I go, okay, I have to make a decision now. But up until that point, you know, both sports, all the sports, they all helped me develop one way or another. The other side of this, and I say this to many multi-sport athletes, is you got to realize that, you know, football is a full scholarship sport. Baseball is not a full scholarship sport. Mm-hmm. I was blessed to go to the University of Iowa and had the commitment from both programs that allowed me to play both sports. But it also allowed me to be a full scholarship player. I mean, full scholarship student athlete. Whereas if I was solely just a baseball player, you're going to struggle to get the money that it would take to go to college on a scholarship. So I think the more you bring to the table, the more there is for you to actually accomplish because you actually can pull scholarship dollars from the different sports. When I look at, you know, my childhood and growing up, again, I think adversity makes us the people that we are. I think a lot of times when you I call it just, you know, the grind that you have to go through
to get
where you're going. And it's during those trying times that you really find out, you know, that you are a champion and that you're made to be a champion if you're able to make it through all of those struggles.
Wow, well said. And I'll tell you what a great lead-in to when you talk about struggles. We are all going through a struggle now, 190 countries. You're a man of faith. You're a leader. You know, you've got leadership programs that you teach the coaches and players. I want to recommend everybody go to bowenterprise.com. Check out his website. Unbelievable. Great stuff. You could talk about that later. But what's your message in these times to everybody, but also because we have players and coaches around the world sitting in and doing nothing or trying to do something indoors? What's your message to them? How to stay positive and also possibly to do something to get ready for the season?
I tell you, this is the message that I want to send to everyone. I think the threat on the separation between the average person and champions are at an all-time high right now. You know why? Because there are many people that hang around in that average crowd that are going to go backwards because they're going to sit idle and they're going to wait for the country to come back to normality. Whereas what champions do during times like this is champions look for ways that they can pivot their business, they can reinvent themselves, they can make themselves better, they find a way to continue to gain an edge. So my message to each and every person out there today, when you think about this, you know, unsolicited, you know, time in which we've all been awarded, and I say awarded because it's not like any one person can say, well, no, I mean, my world didn't stop because of, you know, COVID-19. Everybody's world came to a halt. Mm. So because everybody's world came to a halt, the true champions that are going to come out the other side of this are the people that are going to use this time to help themselves get better.
And if you were a player right now, if you were a college player, a travel ball player, even a big league guy, what would you be doing to prepare yourself and making yourself better so you're ready for the season also, whether it be mental or physical?
Well, when you start, I mean, obviously your physical workouts are paramount, but I think mental is probably even more important. Yeah. When you, it's the reason why I'm with my future All-Star Sports Development Academy. We're in the process of launching an entire virtual learning institution, because I think when you start to think about development, okay, we understand the physical part of the game. You're gonna grow those skill sets, and it takes repetition to grow those skill sets. When you start to talk about the mental aspect and the mental, you know, progression of development, you can do that virtually. You can do it by tapping into video technology. When you think about all the modern technology we have today, I'm pretty sure all the major league players, they're at home, they're watching their at-bats, they're watching pitchers that they're gonna face. This has forced everyone into a kind of closed-in environment where you have to really tap into, you know what, I'm gonna sit down and evaluate it, my own swing. We spend so much time, you know, worrying about the next opponent and the next opponent. I think this is a great time to evaluate yourself. Evaluate, you know, if you're a hitter, you say to yourself, if I was pitching to me, how would I get myself out? And if you are a pitcher, you say to yourself, if I was a hitter, how would I attack, you know, my arsenal? I think those are ways in which you can really move the needle and you can help yourself. So when you do get back on the field and now competition is across from you, you've mentally taken yourself there and you are a better player.
Fantastic. Love it. You know, I have to say, April 15th is coming up, and that is Jackie Robinson Day. I heard you talk on, you interviewed the president, I believe, of the Negro League as a baseball museum.
Yes.
And, you know, yeah, it was an impactful talk. I really enjoyed it. And I bring that up because not only, you know, was Jackie he got obviously the leader when it came to having African Americans playing the game, but he was ahead of his time when it came to leading that movement. Before even Martin Luther King or, you know, Rosetta Parks, all of them, he was really in the front of all that.
Yes, Jackie Robinson was a pioneer. Actually, I think the movement with baseball and how Jackie Robinson handled, you know, the integration of African Americans into Major League Baseball, I think that sparked a lot of the movements that we saw racially in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you listen to Bob Kendrick talk. I mean, I've had many conversations with him about this topic. And had Jackie Robinson not been able to withstand, you know, the hatred and all of the pressure that came with him being integrated into Major League Baseball, it could have set our country back another 20 years. And I mean, people think about, you know, leadership and really got to realize that Jackie Robinson's display of leadership was the fact that he completely humbled himself and took all of the hatred and negativity and used it as a positive to go out and play some of the best baseball in the history of our game. And that's why he's enshrined in the Hall of Fame.
I got to tell you, if I was in his shoes, I'm not sure I would have been able to deal with the things that he had to go through. You know, I would want to jump in those stands and go after somebody, and how he was able to withstand all that. And I'm sure he understood. And he was young, but I'm sure he understood, you know, where he was heading and how he was being a leader for everybody else.
And I think that's a great point, Peter, because, again, what you have to realize when you're placed into a leadership position, one of the first things that you have to come to grips with is that it's no longer about you. And if Jackie Robinson was to put himself before everyone else, he would have jumped in the stands because he would have felt like, I need to defend myself. But because he understood the big picture and he understood that this is not about Jackie Robinson. This is about the African-American race. This is about integration. This is about moving this ball forward in a manner in which I want to make sure that others that are coming behind me have an opportunity. So he understood the how big of a magnifying glass it was placed on him, and he knew the challenges that would come after him had he not been able to be successful.
How have you now, because you've gone on, you've had to manage, coach, not only different levels, but also different people, Latins, Latin players, possibly Japanese. Now you've got all these different players. What have you taken from your playing times and also, some of your early coaching times and things that you learned from other leaders into your job as a manager?
I tell you, I said this on another show that I was on, but I actually wish that the time in which I had in the front office with John Hart and John Schoholtz and Bobby Cox, when I went back to the Braves and was a third base coach for 2 years, and then they moved me into the front office. I think that development, if I had that development before I managed, I think I would have dealt with the managerial boots on the ground position better. And that's why I say, if it is in the cards and I get enough opportunity to manage, I surely believe that I'm going to be better my second time than I was the first time. I think what happens, Peter, when you spend your entire career, I call it boots on the ground, as a coach, as a player, and you're on the field. When you become an executive and you're now in the front office, your views go more to a global view. And the global view is, okay, we're looking at the organization as a whole. Whereas when you're boots on the ground, you're just thinking, how do I win this baseball game today?
Yeah.
I can care less about, what's going to happen next week or next year. So I think that experience, it really helped me come full circle within the game to understand that there's a hierarchy to each decision and why you're doing what you're doing. And again, come say 8-9 years ago, you couldn't get me to use the word rebuilding. Because in my mind, in a competition, the only thing you can do is win and lose.
Yeah.
Whereas from a strategic business standpoint, there's more to that puzzle. It's more to that puzzle. And again, you have to ask yourself the question, there are 10 teams that make the playoffs. Let's take baseball, for example. Mm-hmm. There are 10 teams that make the playoffs. Okay. The other 20 are losers. Now, within that other 20, there's probably 5 or 6 that are going to be on the brink of making the playoffs and end up not making it. So you have to ask yourself, and you have to be able to be honest and evaluate your organization. At the same time, you have to be able to evaluate your opponents as well, because that's how you get to figure out, okay, are we one of those 16 teams that have a chance to compete for a championship? And if you don't have a chance to compete for a championship, you have to make the tough decision of how do we navigate this season with the projection of knowing that if we manage this season right, we're going to have a chance to win 2 years from now and be in a position to not just win 2 years from now, but win for the next 10 years. And there are a lot of organizations that just fall in that gray area, and they never get out of the gray area because they are afraid to make that concrete decision of building a sustainable champion.
Absolutely. I'm going to continue this a little bit, but I want to ask you this. As a manager, you know, you said something important. You said, I wish I knew what basically, you know, what you know now back then. When I was in Belgium, that was my very first time managing, and I can go back and look at the same thing. Man, I'm looking now going, wow, I tried so hard, worked so hard, but I make 1,000 mistakes. And I want to ask you, what are some of the mistakes that you made in your early careers that helped you understand now and you can teach to others?
Well, I think early in my career, you know, as a manager, especially the only example I have at the major league level is Houston, is one, not taking the situation for exactly what it was and allowing the losing to actually just beat me down. When, again, I think part of being a competitor, and I think we all have this competitive nature where, again, it's black and white. It's either you win or you lose. Whereas if I was put in that situation again, do you know that to me, a person that's put in a situation, your success is going to be determined this way, in my opinion. Did you leave the situation better than it was when you arrived? And had I put that at the forefront of my mind of saying, okay, Bo, you don't have a championship team, but I want it so hard to win. And Bill Parcells told me this, and it's probably the best advice that I received. It was in my second year. He said, you know, some situations won't allow you to win. And my friend, you find yourself in that kind of situation. So one of the hardest thing for a competitor is accepting that you're in a situation that technically won't allow you to win today, but you have to carry on as a winner. And the way you carry on as a winner is your success and your joy has to be found in other small victories, not in the win-loss column. They have to be found in, how do I make this player better? How do I make the organization better? What can I do today so that we are better 5 years from now? And you cannot allow yourself to fall into the trap. This is the trap you fall into. Am I going to be here 5 years from now? Am I going to be here 3 years from now? You may not be there tomorrow. It's not even about whether or not you're going to be there. It's about you doing the best job you can as a leader because you've been charged to lead at that very moment.
You know, speaking about leading, as a manager, when you've had players who maybe you didn't think hustled enough or didn't finish a play or, you know, mentally were not into the game, how did you deal with that? Because, you know, that's not an easy thing to deal with, you know, and how to tell players, you know, hey, you did this wrong or you need to do this better, whatever the situation may be.
You know, I'm going to give you two examples. And one, I handled well, and the other, I didn't handle too well. We were in Seattle, and I had a young team. A lot of young players, and they were growing up in the big leagues. Some of them probably was rushed to the big leagues and probably should not have been there. There were other players that, you know, probably should not have been in the big leagues, but because we were in a rebuild, they were getting at bats. But we were in Seattle, and the hitting coach, John Maley, and I, we had talked to the players about managing their at bats and understanding, you know, that you have to work counts. You have to understand what happens in front of you. Well, J.D. Martinez, who, you know, is a great player. The first guy swings at the first pitch. The second guy swings at the second pitch. He goes up. He's the third hitter. He swings at the first pitch. And we had just had a meeting about this.
Wow.
Okay. So a young manager, myself, immediately, I pull him out of the game. He gets pulled out of the game. So now, as the manager, the first question I'm going to get is, why did he get pulled out of the game?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't handle this well. And again, this is the growing stages of being a manager. I basically, you know, said to the media, this is something we talked about. You know, JD understood exactly why he came out of the game. JD Martinez, he actually handled it well. The media came to him. He said, no. He said, you know, Bo, I understand why he took me out of the game. I got to do better there. I need to manage my bat better. I look at that scenario, and again, it was a learning curve for me because something similar happened, I would say, a few months later, and this was with Jose Altuve. And after that JD Martinez situation, I took a step back and I talked to some of my mentors, and it was my growth in emotional sensitivity. And I think as a leader, we all have to exercise emotional sensitivity. It's not just what you say and what you do. It's how you say it and when you say it. Hmm. So we're in Chicago. Jose Altuve is in the middle of his first contract extension. They're negotiating. They're going back and forth. You know, he's, you know, dealing with that strain. This is the first time he's ever, you know, had these kind of conversations. And he's going to, you know, sign his first big contract. Well, he hits a ground ball to the shortstop. And unlike Altuve, he jogs down the first baseline. The shortstop bobbles the ball, throws the ball to the first baseman. The first baseman drops the ball and then had time to pick it up. And he's out.
Wow. Okay?
And I'm sitting there. And Dave Trimley, who is my bench coach, I mean, Aguado Perez, sorry, who's the bench coach, he looks at me, and I said, I'll deal with it. And he looks at me again. I said, I'll deal with it. So I go back to the hotel that night, and I go, okay, I'm going to have to deal with this. The next day, I get to the ballpark. I tell Aguado Perez, I said, do not post the lineup until Altuve get here and tell him to come see me. Altuve comes to the ballpark. He gets there probably, and normally the players are on the road. They're at the ballpark 1:32 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Altuve comes rolling in at 3 o'clock, and he's got new Louis Vuitton bag and new watch. He's been on Michigan Avenue. He's been shopping. And he comes in. I said, come in, sit down. And he come in. And he goes. He said, Coach. He goes, new guy today. He said, I went shopping, got a new backpack. He goes, new attitude, new guy today. I said, sit down. I said, you know what? I don't like the new guy. I said, you know why? Because the new guy don't play hard. I said, I like the old guy. The old guy was hungry. I said, let me tell you something. There's many players that have gotten one contract in Major League Baseball. I said, you better make sure that this is not your last. I said, what happened last night was unacceptable. I said, and you're one of the leaders of this team. I said, now, I could have taken you out of the game last night. I said, but I've grown as a leader, and that's why I didn't do it. Mm. I said, but you're not playing. I said, but you're not playing today. I said, I want you to think about what happened last night, and you'll be back in there tomorrow. He turned around. He walked out of my office. He turned right back around in 10 seconds. He closed the door. He said, I apologize. I promise it would never happen again. He goes, but please, let me play. I said, okay. I said, this is the thing. This is not about me. I said, this is about the other 24 guys out there. I said, because if I let you get away with this, I said, I'm going to lose their respect. I said, so you need to go take care of the 24 guys out there. And if you go take care of them, I'll let you play. Jose Altuve goes out there. He apologized to his teammates. I put him in the lineup. He goes 5 for 5.
Wow.
We win the game. Not only that, Jose Altuve, from that day in Chicago, has the most hits in Major League Baseball since that day.
Wow, now, what a...
I don't take credit. I tell the story, but I don't take credit. But the message to anyone that's in a leadership position, that's in a coaching position, you are charged to tell them what they really don't want to hear. That's what you're charged to do. So I'm going to tell you this much. Jose Altuve didn't speak to me for about 2 weeks. He goes home. The season ends, and our relationship is cordial, you know, but he was upset because I said some things to him that I'm not going to say on your show, but I said some other things to him. He goes home. He tells his dad what happens. What happened? His dad told him, when you get back to the States, he said, I want you to hug that man and tell him thank you because that man loved you. The following season, the first day of spring training, Jose Altuve comes into my office and he looks me in the eye. He said, I want to apologize to you. And I said, for what? Now, I then completely forgot about this.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out how are we going to win more than 51 games this year. He comes in, I apologize. And I go, apologize for what? He said, for what happened in Chicago last year. He said, you know, I was mad at you. He said, there's only two people that ever talked to me the way you talked to me. My dad and you. He said, and I told my dad what happened. He said, and my dad told me, you apologize to that man because that man loved you. He goes, he said, I am going to play as hard as I can for you. I'm not going to accept that this team losing. And I appreciate you. And again, that was a profound moment for me as a manager because, one, I think about how I handled the J.D. Martinez situation. Fast forward, how I handled the Altuve situation. And again, managing and leadership is about growth.
Mm-hmm.
It's about trial and error. It's about, you know, being authentic. It's about being vulnerable and accepting the role in which you play. You're not always going to make the right decisions. And just because you're the manager don't give you the right to say, well, I was wrong, but it don't matter. That's not good leadership. And at the end of the day, you know, that growth helped with my relationship with not just Altuve, with all the players.
You know, and it's interesting because you would think, you know, your first time managing, especially in the big leagues, you've got a lot of guys, you know, obviously making a lot of money, you know, been around the game a little bit. You think you'd want to go in and impress people, but it makes sense to be more vulnerable at times and show that you don't know everything. But one question I do have, and you said telling somebody something they don't want to hear necessarily because it's tough. How do you do that? I mean, where did you get that ability to do that? Because that's not easy to tell somebody something that they don't want to hear. So especially when you tell them possibly we're cutting you, you know, we're releasing you. When you're making those tough decisions, where do you get that from?
Well, I'm going to tell you, my defensive back coach at University of Iowa, Bob Elliott, rest in peace. He was a great mentor, you know, for me. He used to say something that really stuck with me. He said, do you know the only thing worse than a player with no confidence? It's a player with false confidence.
Hmm.
So it's almost like players ask themselves two things every day. The people that you're charged to lead, they ask themselves these two things every day. Do you care about me more than you care about yourself? And can I trust them? And as a leader, you want the answer to both of those questions to be yes. Because if they know that you care about them, and that's why it's so important to connect with the people that you are charged to lead. Because at some point, you're going to have to engage.
Yes.
And if you've never connected, that engagement is probably going to be fragmented. But if they know that you care about them as a person, at the moment in which it comes time to engage, it's going to be received totally differently. So I think, again, the last thing you want to do is to be untruthful and the player walk away and someone else, a real leader, come along and tell them the truth. Then they're going to go, well, why does such and such lie to me? Hmm. So now you've lost all credibility.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know, this is the one thing about the truth. The truth gives you a chance to actually make a true adjustment. If someone tells you something that is not true, and now you're believing that, and you're moving on thinking that everything is okay, That's false confidence.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do as a leader is to give someone false confidence. Now, I go back to emotional sensitivity. I think that that is the biggest learning curve for leaders, is knowing what to say and when to say it.
Mm.
It's like, okay, do you really want to say something to a guy about slamming his helmet or throwing his bat after he strikes out with the bases loaded and the game on the line? That's probably a conversation you can have doing stretch the next day.
Yeah.
Just walking around casually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I learned that from, you know, talking to Bobby Cox and, you know, Dusty Baker. And they said, you know, the best time to talk to your players is doing batting practice when you're walking around or they're out shagging. Just walk out there and porch up next to them and talk. It kind of takes down a lot of the barriers that you would have when you call them into your office.
Mm-hmm.
And again, something at the magnitude of Altuve, that was a let's sit down in my office and talk about it. But there are other things that take place throughout the course of the day, whether it's lineup construction, whether it's, you know, changing someone's role, you know, those are conversations that should happen in just, you know, the daily walks of interaction that kind of takes down those barriers of, you know, player manager.
You know, when you're a manager, you're dealing with a lot of people, whether it's your coaching staff, trainers, players, you know, minor league stuff. When you're dealing with a big organization, I mean, it's very similar to a business, obviously. Sometimes you've got some clicks. Sometimes you've got the blame game going on. Especially, we all know when we're losing, that's when, you know, like you said earlier, when the tough times are tough, that's when you really get to know somebody. How did you keep that train going in the same direction and avoid some of these things?
I tell you, you know, people talk about building championships, and I'm a firm believer in this. We don't build championships as leaders. What you build is you build people, and the people will build the championship. I don't have to look any farther for this example here. Just look at the 2019 Washington Nationals.
Yeah.
And people ask me the question, like, how did this team do it? Well, they did it because they were exactly that. They were a team. It's very easy to point fingers and play the blame game when things don't go well. But you really find out the core and the cloth in which you're cut from when things don't go well. And as a leader, again, I think one of the best attributes that we all can have is that when things go wrong, we literally take the blame. And you can take more blame than you probably deserve. But our job is to actually solve problems for our players and to put them in the best position to be successful. So if you're able to take the blame off of them, it basically frees them up to do what? Go out and play. But what happens when your leader is able to do that, it actually makes your players take more ownership. Have you ever noticed on teams, if the management or leader is pointing the blame to the players, how that become an infight?
Absolutely.
Whereas if the manager or the leader actually takes ownership of it, the players eventually just go, you know what? This is not on the manager. We need to be better.
Yes.
Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. I mean, Chicago's a great example. Joe Madden's fantastic at that. He takes everything on his shoulders. Yes. And tries to take it away from his players.
Yes, and that's what we're supposed to do, because our job is to put them in the best position to be successful. So anytime you can alleviate them of any stress, the better it is for the players.
You know, hey, Bo, you've been great. I mean, we're getting close. We got about 10 more minutes. And I tell you what, we can go on for hours with something like this. And I can see why you're a keynote speaker. And because I think you're speaking not just to baseball coaches and managers, but you're speaking to life in general. But, it's interesting. I wanted to jump in because I heard you talk about analytics a little bit, how it they've helped the game, how you can use them at your advantage. And I'm sure there's ways that you could use them at your advantage, but there's also maybe some disadvantages. Love for your, you know, understanding in some of that.
Well, Peter, can I grab my charger real quick?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, we're on Facebook Live with Pete Caliendo and Bo Porter. You can see his jersey there. Bo Porter, a former major league player. Matter of fact, his first time up in the big leagues was in Chicago as a Chicago Cubs. He is a keynote speaker. former manager, coach, assistant GM. He's done so much in the game. He's got a great website. Check it out. Bo Porter Enterprise. You know, we've been talking a lot about some great stuff here. Hang in there, folks, because Bo's coming right back. But want to tell you that I want to wish everybody hopefully a safe time at home. Stay at home. Remember that if we do this, you could tell right away that we're starting to, you know, battle and fight the virus. And I think that's a tribute to everybody in the U.S. and also around the world. This is a world epidemic, and we have to work together. You know, we've got 190 countries in this. If you know, in baseball, we've got about 130 countries playing the game of baseball. So everybody now is suffering a little bit, but Bo gave some advice earlier, and check it out, on some of the things that you can do at home mentally and physically to prepare yourself for when the season starts. So here we are again with Bo Porter. Yes, Paul, go ahead, Bo.
So, no, going back to your question in analytics, it's I've always said it's a tool that's in the toolbox. It's not the toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, the game is based on numbers. It always has been based on
numbers.
That's why the team with the most runs win the game. But when you think about analytics and the role it has played in our game, I think one of the best things that analytics has allowed us to do is given us a way to actually place true value on players. It also has helped the in-game decision-making. People, you know, when shift defenses first came in, and I want to talk about this because I think this was kind of like the evolution. And people didn't really understand, you know, why teams started shifting players.
Right.
And I think what happened in some organizations is that the players didn't have enough information to buy into shifting and the advantages of it. So what I did is I sat down with our players and I said, this is a psychological advantage that we are gaining. I'm going to explain to you why.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's just take David Ortiz, Big Poppy, for example. Okay. He's going to hit 40 home runs. He's going to drive in 120, and he's going to have an OPS that's north of 925. Okay. When you think about a player that possesses that kind of power, that kind of ability, what happens when you start shifting the field is a lot of players say to themselves, well, man, I can't hit the ball through the shift. So,
Bo, you know, this has been fantastic. There's so much we can go into, but I also want to reach out and let everybody know about your charities. So let's talk about your charities, what you're doing, and then we'll go into the next thing.
Yes, Bo Porter Charities, again, you know, we foster programs and events for underprivileged, underserved families and children. Education is one of our biggest pillows. Sports development. Also, we have our sponsor a child Christmas drive every year. We do. Going back to the story in New Jersey, you know, the only part I didn't tell you is the field where Mr. Taylor took me to go sign up when I was 9 years old. Fast forward to 2015. I get a call from the mayor of Newark, Ras Baraka, who is a dear friend of mine. Him and I grew up together. They renamed Green Acres Marquez Bo Porter Sports Complex.
Wow.
So that same field that I was dropped off at to sign up and play at Southport Little League, it now is named Marquez Bo Porter Sports Complex. Little League Baseball, Small Fry Basketball, Pop Warner Football. We have a tutorial program, after school tutorial program for all the kids in the community. Every year we have our coat drive. I do it through the mayor's office, and it was something we started 5 years ago because I felt like I wanted to do something that was going to be more lasting than just giving kids toys. We give kids toys as well, but you know, growing up in the East Coast, the weather is bad. It gets cold. And for those families, you know, last year we did 175 families. For those families that know that their child is going to get a winter coat, you know, every year, I just think it's something that's long lasting and it's very much needed in that climate and in that community.
That's fantastic. Boy, if it wasn't for people like you, some of these kids would not have much to look forward to. And I think that's great what you're doing. You also had a program with Major League Baseball. I thought it was a pretty good program. I was reading about it. They called it Camp Jobless. But, you know, it really helped because there were players out there that really didn't know where they're going to be going. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes. Again, this when you talk about analytics, I think analytics really put a freeze on the market during that offseason. And there was a lot of uncertainty for a lot of veteran players because jobs just was not, you know, not coming open and teams were not signing players. But again, that goes back to that business model that the organization is looking at and going, okay, we're not going to win. We're not going to allocate dollars to make our on-field product better. So therefore, we're going to give playing time to more minimum wage, you know, players. And it left a lot of proven veterans kind of just sitting in no man's land. And the union stepped in. When you think about the Players Association, you know, they had to do something that would send a message to their players that we are here for you. Mm. And, you know, Tony Clark, he called me and said, hey, you know, you're a former manager. You've run spring training. You've done, you know, all these things in the game. You know, I can't think of no better person than to have you come and run this camp, put it together. I was able to get a complete staff of former major league players and coaches that came in, and it was great for the players. One thing for sure is that it sent the message to the ball clubs that you can sign these players because they are participating in a real spring training structure, and a sure. lot of players signed and went on to help major league clubs that year.
Well, here in Chicago, we have, and we're going to finish with, the last thing we'll finish with after this is, I'm just going to let you talk to our coaches, players, and parents, any last message you have for them, you know, to inspire them into, you know, being a great leader. But we have the ACE program, Chicago White Sox program, that goes into the inner city. They've done a fantastic job. I think it's a model for the country because they've got a lot of kids playing college baseball. You saw it in the College World Series. We had some players from the Chicago area. Your advice to whether it be Major League teams, Major League Baseball, whether it be any organization in helping develop, because we seem to be moving, but not moving fast enough into developing young players in the inner city, you know, when it comes to baseball, because they all want to play basketball, you know, and other sports, but they're not going towards the baseball aspect.
Well, again, I think one of the main reasons is start at the price point. When you think about basketball, parents are going to buy their kids shoes anyway. So if a parent buy their son or daughter, you know, basketball shoes that they're going to wear to school, they become a dual purpose. They can wear the basketball shoes to school and they can play basketball in them.
Mm-hmm.
When you start thinking about basketball, there's basketball courts, you know, everywhere. You can grab a ball and really a kid can grab a ball and go shoot. They don't really need anybody else, you know, with them. When you start to look at baseball and the price points that come with the game, from cleats to batting gloves,
yep.
to, you know, fielding glove to...
And everything's travel ball now.
Everything is travel ball. So it becomes a pay-to-play model. It's not that many community leagues that are out there where kids get to actually play the game for free. One of the things that I try to do within all of my programming is make sure that we make it affordable. So mm-hmm. one of the things I would say to anyone that's in youth development, I understand the business model and that you want to monetize your product and your services, but have some mechanism in place that, you know, kind of strips it down from a pricing standpoint that allows families to actually be able to enjoy the game and allow their kids the opportunity to develop. When you think about development, I would say this to all coaches, okay? Move out of the transactional space and move into the transformational space. Stop putting so much of an emphasis on winning games for 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds. It's not about winning games. I'm gonna share this story. And again, Coach Hayden Fry, who I was blessed to play football for at Iowa, this was my senior year. And, you know, I was preseason All Big Ten, and we having our Big Ten media day. So we're sitting on a podium, and one of the reporters asked Coach Fry, they said, hey, you know, you're returning a bunch of seniors. You know, looks like you guys are going to have a pretty good team this year. You know, talk to us. I mean, what kind of team do you think you're going to have? And I remember sitting there, Coach Fry responded to the reporter. He said, well, you know, in 1984, I was a really good coach. He said, you know, Chuck Long went on to be an All-American. He's coaching at San Diego State. You know, Bob Stoops is at Oklahoma. He started naming players from those teams and what they were doing, you know, post their University of Iowa career.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I was like, I said, Coach Fry didn't ask this man questions. So he finished by saying, he said, so I don't really know what kind of team I'm going to have this year. He said, but check back with me 20 years from now. I want to see what kind of men these guys turn out to be. And then I'll let you know what kind of team I had.
So absolutely.
All coaches, it's not about the here and the now. It's about transforming lives, and that when they leave you whole. And I'll say this to parents, you know, stop trying to safeguard your kids from failure. You know, a lot of parents, they jump from team to team. You know, he couldn't play on this team, so I'm going to move him over here. You know what? Sometimes your kids need to fight through that.
Yeah.
They need to fight through the fact that they're not playing, and they need to, because I've never met a coach that don't want to win.
Right.
So if your kid is not playing, you know, maybe there's a reason why your kid is not playing. And now you can, you know, remove your kid from that team and they go to another team. But now they've lost that life lesson that was very that was needed.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not sure we need a final message. That was a great message. Bo, got to thank you. You went way over your time that I actually sent to you. I can't thank you enough, man. I've been looking forward to meeting you in person after when this is all over. God bless you, and thanks for being on the show, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, that is Bo Porter. I am Pete Caliendo. I'm host of Baseball Outside the Box. We will take Bo's information, all his website information, his Twitter, how to contact him, and put it on the show notes. Don't forget, join us tomorrow, 11 o'clock again, Central Time, for another great show. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Stay safe. Wishing you a great day. God bless you. Ciao, and see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.